Tonight on Arena, Ron and Russell Mail or Sparks tell us how 2021 is shaping up for them, and Joe Caslin on his part in the National Library's Living with Pride. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The musical brothers, Ron and Russell Mail, better known as Sparks, have been an eccentric, unclassifiable duo for more than 50 years and have played a pivotal role in multiple musical movements, from glam rock to new wave to synth pop. Their songs, along with their distinctive image and stage presence, burst onto the glam rock scene in the early 1970s. And for many on this side of the Atlantic, interest in Sparks started with their appearance on Top of the Pops, with Ron sporting his trademark Hitler moustache and Russell looking like Mark Bolan and singing this song. This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us was a huge hit for Sparks, appearing on their third album, Kimono My House. But Sparks never stood still, and with 25 albums to their name, they often followed up their biggest moments of success with radical shifts in style. Now entering their sixth decade, 2021 sees the release of their movie musical Annette, starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, and their career is explored and celebrated in The Sparks Brothers, a documentary from director Edgar Wright. And I'll be speaking with the brothers shortly about that film. But Sparks are often referred to as your favourite band's favourite band. And with a 50-year-long career to date, they have gathered a fan base of old and young musicians and performers from across all genres of music, as you'll hear in this clip from the documentary, The Sparks Brothers.
When I first discovered Sparks, I never thought of them as being American at all. I thought of them just being as, like, Sparks.
They're otherworldly.
I always thought Sparks were a British band.
They're the best British group ever to come out of America.
Just sweet America.
They are a total enigma to me. They are a band who you can look up on Wikipedia and know nothing.
Who the fuck are these guys?
Ron has a huge snow globe collection. I'm like, oh, really?
It's quite special and odd.
If you try to describe them to people, it's like, what do they sound like? Sparks.
The work speaks for itself, so I don't have to know them.
All pop music is rearranged Vince Clark and rearranged Sparks. That's the truth.
We have influenced everyone.
Honestly, I don't want to see this movie. I don't want to learn too much about them. I'll watch it because I'm in it.
What do you think about me calling the documentary The Sparks Brothers?
In lieu of anything better.
Yeah.
We hate that name.
A montage of voices there from the documentary The Sparks Brothers. Among those you heard were Flea, Jonathan Ross, Bernard Butler, Alex Kapranos, Jason Schwartzman, and a whole bundle of others trying to define Sparks. And at the very end of that selection of voices, you heard Ron and Russell Mail, also known as Sparks. And I'm delighted to be speaking with both of them this evening. I was just thinking, Russell, your 2020 album, A Slow Drip, 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 you certainly couldn't say that about 2021 with the two films in particular, the documentary that we're going to speak about, and of course your own film, Annette. It looks as if it's a good year for Sparks.
No, it is. We're thrilled beyond words that when it rains, it pours. And now not only having this amazing documentary from a great director, Edgar Wright, but having a movie musical that we wrote, that's starring Adam Driver and Cotillard, and it's just been the opening film at the Cannes Film Festival. We were there for the last 2 weeks, and not only opening the Cannes Film Festival, but also winning two awards, one for Best Director for Leos Carax, who directed it, and then we, as Sparks, winning an award for the Best Soundtrack album. So it's like kind of a unbelievable period for us right at the moment.
It certainly is that, although you've had lots of unbelievable periods during your 5 decades really in performance, in the world of performance. But Ron, when I'm sure lots of people had come to you over the years wanting to make a documentary about Sparks and trying to understand the process that is behind your artistic work, what was it that made you trust, allowed you to trust Edgar Wright?
Well, one of the things is just that we are really passionate about his films. We, other people have come to us with the idea of doing a documentary about Sparks, and we've always declined, you know, partly because we didn't have faith in them as a filmmaker, and we love Edgar Wright's films. And then also Edgar kind of came with the thesis, the idea that he felt that all of Sparks' periods were strong, that there wasn't like some golden age in the past, and that there were then 17 albums after that were kind of the decline of this creative force. And so that, you know, obviously that's kind of how, that's how we see ourselves, whether it, you know, whether there's any self-delusion in that or not, but we see ourselves as being creatively doing as strong a work as we've done at any time. And so the combination of those two things is what really convinced us to say yes at this time, where we had said no in the past to other people.
I think for most people, or for a lot of people, particularly in this part of the world, in Europe, Kimono My House 1974 and the song This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us will be, if you say Sparks, I think that's what a lot of people will say immediately. When you were making that album, you had moved from the US to the UK to make that album. Can you remember the kind of artistic mindset that you were in at that time, Russell?
Yeah, well, you know, we had moved to London from LA, and, you know, getting to fulfill our dream actually of becoming a British band. And we had had 2 albums prior to that time, and then fortunately this one song that Ron had written, This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, became a huge massive hit. But, you know, one thing that we really like about the documentary with Edgar's documentary is that he wants to try to you know, dispel the myth in a certain way that the golden era of Sparks was the This Town era, or the golden era was Number One in Heaven era, or the golden era was When Do I Get to Sing My Way. That in fact Sparks' career is really unique, and there's just one kind of golden era, and that it's still ongoing. And so that was something that was real we were really happy about with the documentary, was that Edgar wanted to stress that and try to rectify the fact that maybe some people do feel that, you know, the Kimono My House and This Town era was the one era that they are most familiar with. And he was hoping with this documentary to be able to say, look, there's been 24 or 20, whatever, it's been 22 albums since that time that Sparks has done, and so much of it really being as important in his mind as that album was. And so that was one thing we were really happy about with the documentary.
Although one of the things, rather, I don't want to stick with that period in time, but one thing I do want to say that we hear particularly in that song is the quality of your voice, Russell. And Ron, you getting to write for that voice as you have done, and the quality of the voice is still there in the recent albums as well. Writing for that voice, it strikes me that there's a kind of symbiotic quality somehow between the two of you as brothers and artists. This ability for Russell to deliver your lyrics and your music, Ron, but also for you to write for that extraordinary, almost operatic voice, it has to be said.
That's true, because I always have faith that whatever I'm going to write is going to be able to be kind of performed in the ideal way, just because Russell is the singer. I mean, it isn't even, I'm even past the point, you know, quite a long time ago of just thinking, is this going to work? You know, who is the singer? I don't even think in those terms, because I just know it's going to always work. You know, Russell has the flexibility, the kind of stylistic eccentricity that fits the eccentricity of the music. And so, you know, it's something that, you know, we don't even think about, but but is kind of the key thing, that there isn't a separation between the songs and the singing, that it's kind of all one thing.
But sticking with that idea of stylistic eccentricity, what's really striking over the 25 albums and the five decades is this constant ability to change style and to change from, you know, from the early era of This Town Ain't Big Enough into the Giorgio Moroder era, into the later eras as well. I'm guessing that you don't go out, or do you go out saying, let's be stylistically eccentric here? Is there something else driving those changes, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that case. It's just something inherent in what we do, and a desire each time we set out to do a new album to do something that we feel is fresh and really provocative and striking, and to hopefully not be repeating ourselves each time. And you know, it becomes a big creative task to achieve that, and especially the longer the career you have, it becomes more and more difficult. And that's why each time we start off to do a new album, we're really kind of pushing ourselves to try to make it as though it might be the first album that someone has ever heard of Sparks, and that this new album of ours has to be the one that represents everything that Sparks is about. And so we approach albums in that way, and we, you know, so each time we do a stylistically new interpretation of what Sparks is, you know, we really go at it with a real desire to make it be something unique. And I think it's something that a lot of Sparks fans really appreciate, that they never really know what the next move will be by us creatively. And I think they kind of really enjoy that kind of unknown quality about where we're headed each time we start out.
For sure, and that's really what comes across in the documentary, what Edgar Wright gives to us. The film itself, the film world itself, you started out, your father used to bring you to matinees on Saturday afternoons, and you used to go in late to them sometimes. The film is dedicated to your parents, Ron, and I was really struck by that, and I'm really struck by the brotherly relationship between the two of you. How do you think that early life fed into the facility you have to be chameleon-like in your artistic expression?
Well, I think that our parents always really encouraged us to do creative things. I mean, neither of our parents were musical in a traditional sense, but they always, whatever we kind of got involved with, and when we got involved with music, they encouraged that. I mean, our father was a graphic design person in a newspaper, but also a painter. But he would come home with rock records for some reason that obviously he loved, and our musical education was from, you know, him bringing these 78s of Elvis and Little Richard, and so, you know, just that kind of seeping in of all of this modern pop culture, and of matinee movies and of popular music, you know, it obviously had an effect on us that would kind of lead to us being interested in actually being in a band.
And one thing, as we finish up, I'd like to ask Russell is, it would seem the band that you left behind when you started in America, the band that you left behind when you went back from the UK back to America, and several other people who have worked with you throughout the years, and you two brothers, there never seems to have been a crossword between any of you, if we're to judge by Edgar Wright's documentary. Never a fight. How have you maintained such good relationships over five decades with so many different people?
No, that's something that we're really proud of with the documentary, that there, you know, we had to make really tough decisions with some of the band members that we had throughout our career. And, you know, especially the first band that we had in Los Angeles, where we had to make a decision when Ron and I were offered an opportunity to come to the UK to reform with British musicians. And these people were our friends, but this was kind of our dream to come to the UK and actually become a British band. So we had to make really tough decisions along the way. And what we're so happy about, and so happy that Edgar included in the documentary, is that a lot of the band members from the past are interviewed in the documentary, and they say that they completely understand why we had to make certain decisions that we did throughout our career. And there's not bitterness at all being displayed by them. And they're actually happy that we've gone on to be successful and continued on with our vision. And there's one band member, Ian Hampton, who says, well, we're doing art for art's sake, and that he understood why we had to make certain decisions that where we changed the band, and so he, you know, and so it just was really heartwarming for us to hear from past band members that they've kind of, although they've been disappointed, certainly that they really understood what the decisions were we made, and that they still are really proud to have been in Sparks, even for whatever period it was and however long it was.
Well, it sure is a delight to watch a documentary where people praise each other rather than tear each other down and tell us all about why they broke up and why they had rows. I'm finishing up with the most recent thing then that I can finish up with, which is something from the soundtrack from Annette, featuring both of you performing, Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard here as well, and Simon Helberg. After the disappointment with Jacques Tati, the disappointment with Tim Burton, how brilliant was it to finally get a film project out there, Ron?
Oh, it was unbelievable, because, you know, we have had those kind of setbacks that were incredibly disappointing just because of our passion for film and the marriage of film and music. So to actually have a film not only get made, but be the opening night film at the Cannes Film Festival with a great director like Neos Carax, I mean, it's just a dream for us.
Listen, lovely to have spoken with both of you and have learned so much about you over the 2.5 hours of the documentary. Thanks for being with us on the programme this evening.
Thank you.
Pair of gentlemen indeed, Ron and Russell Mail. And Edgar Wright's documentary, The Sparks Brothers, will be released on Friday the 30th of July. We'll be reviewing it on tomorrow's programme. In fact, Annette is released on the 3rd of September of this year. But to whet our appetite for that, let's have a listen to some of the soundtrack, as I mentioned. Here's a track called So May We Start. Well, they certainly haven't lost their sense of theatre and their sense of the operatic, have they, the Sparks Brothers there? So may we start from their musical movie, Annette, featuring Simon Helberg, Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard in there, as well as the Sparks Brothers. That film, Annette, will be released on the 3rd of September. The documentary that they were speaking to us about, released this week in cinemas, we'll be reviewing it on tomorrow night's Arena. 27 minutes past 7 on Tuesday nights, or Wednesday nights, Arena. You might remember that last night Gary Hines of Druid Theatre Company was on the show talking to us about the upcoming production of The Seagull in Coole Park. Now, we were made aware before the show that after a long and debilitating illness that the actor, dancer and one-time member of Druid Theatre Company, Ray McBride, had died earlier. We chose not to mention it at the time out of respect to his family and friends who were just hearing the sad news. Ray was a gifted actor, having starred in many of Druid Theatre shows, including Wood of the Whispering and Conversations on a Homecoming, and on the Dublin stage and internationally, as well as having many memorable film roles such as Reefer and the Model. He was, as I said, a renowned dancer, bringing joy to all he performed for, like in this appearance on The Late Late Show with Gay Byrne and Micheál O'Sullivan on the piano. Ray gave a tour de force exploration of Irish dance.
Well, I tell you, going through My career as an Irish dancer, since I was 4 years of age, you learn how to dance, and you're sent to dancing.
Yes.
And there's a strict regimental rule with the straight harems, and don't smile, point your toes, carriage straight, and whatever you do, don't enjoy what you're doing. you know, or the judge will dock your marks. Oh, look, I'm enjoying this. You know, don't laugh. You were laughing on stage. So what I was doing, Gabe, for the last couple of years, often tour with Druid,
yes.
Is developing the dance since I was a young fella, doing the easy reel into the next stage, which is the hard reel or the light reel, into the treble reel, whereas it's nearly the big jump where you get your from the soft shoes into the little tappers, right?
Over to Micheál and explain it as you go along. Micheál, give him a little tune there, whatever it is,
Anyway, with Lash.
Wonderful Ray McBride, clearly getting a lot of joy out of that dancing and not following his coach's advice. And many's the person he entertained with his board, a wooden board that he'd carry around with him on tour and whip it out after a show, after a Druid performance, and then continue to dance into the night on the board and perform all and sundry there. Hard to believe that, in fact, all three mentioned in that clip, Gabe Byrne, Micheál O'Sullivan, and Ray McBride, all gone from us now, Imithe ar Slí na Fireanna. But in particular, tonight, we remember actor and dancer Ray McBride, who died yesterday. Suvnis Siri era anam Gilish. Joe Caslin is an Irish street artist, art teacher and activist, best known for his towering pieces of street art. His accessible work engages directly with social issues of modern Ireland. As part of the National Library of Ireland's Living with Pride programme events, Joe will take part in a panel discussion on identity and creative expression across different media, considering LGBT plus representation and visibility. Delighted that Joe is with us in studio this evening. First of all, we'll talk to you about what I saw in the papers yesterday and the various pictures I saw today. Joe, gorgeous picture of your mural of your friend Amanda Butler. This was to mark the 50th anniversary of Down Syndrome Ireland. Just explain what the mural is, because mural doesn't even begin to explain in my mind what it is.
Yeah, it's a 60-foot drawing and it's located on Harcourt Street. So just as you walk from Harcourt Street into the Ivy Gardens, there's a great gable wall that's there, and it was kind of on my radar for a while. So the image itself is of Amanda Butler. Amanda's a friend of mine. She's 21. She has Down syndrome. She's from Street in Mullingar, just outside Mullingar in County Westmeath. She's actually the sister of my housemate. And then things line up in a kind of a synchronized way. Well, Down Syndrome Ireland were marking their 50th year anniversary. And with that, they are running a campaign called The Upside. So they have 21 demands asking, you know, kind of for the betterment of people with Down syndrome. So it was a perfect opportunity to, you know, kind of engage with a friend and to, you know, kind of showcase her joy. Similar to the piece that we just listened to there. It's the joy just, you know, kind of oozes from the drawing and it comes through, and it comes from Amanda. It's her spirit. It's her energy. And it was a, you know, kind of a great project, because the last year and a half has been tough. It's been a slog in some ways. And I'd love when Amanda would come on the phone and laugh and joke. And she just, lighten your day and just bring beautiful ease.
But I want you to explain how you got that mural up there. I watched a speeded up film of you doing this using a crane of some kind that was moving up and down as you got the drawing up on the wall itself. How long did it actually take?
Putting up the drawing, we worked on the first day was 12 hours. So we started at 5:30 in the evening. A mate of mine came over and dad came up and gave me a hand. And we were there for 12 hours. So we finished at 5:30 the next morning. And then
so you put it up in panels of...
Panels, so like in a large panels of paper. So all of the artwork is, it's biodegradable. It's paper and a biodegradable potato paste. And it's put up in strips. So like wallpapering, just on a massive scale.
Except a 60-foot tall room. Many of us have... So this gable wall, you're not even covering the whole gable wall, but 60 foot of it. It's a huge gable wall.
Yeah.
So you put it up in these strips of 60 foot.
Yeah.
I think I saw it in the speeded up version that took 45 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, that was lovely. And then right at the very end, there's a huge amount of street furniture. So there's like two post boxes and there's a row of you know, the Dublin City Council bikes, and there was a load of, you know, kind of furniture that was there, so that prevented us from finishing off the last section. So I was up this morning and I just finished that, so that's why I'm in the city. It's just to finish off that little last section. So now she rests, and I use the architecture of the building. There's a lintel that runs along, so she kind of leans in with her elbow and just rests and looks out, and she brings this beautiful smile. And whether you engage with her or not is kind of, you know, your call. But
the title of this piece of work says so much.
Yeah, the title is "Don't Talk Down to Me," and it's a play on the word, you know, kind of on the symptom or on the you know, Down syndrome itself. And a lot of you know, kind of people would look at, you know, individuals with Down syndrome as maybe lesser. And my experience, you know, kind of Amanda is, she floats so high above me on many aspects of, you know, kind of who she is as a person. She's far better in many, many ways than I am. And, you know, kind of for society to look on her and others like her as lesser is just, it doesn't sit well. And that kind of, you know, sits in well with the panel discussion with
the National Library
tomorrow. It's, you know, kind of as a queer person being othered and being able to see that within our community or within our, you know, within our society, it kind of is sore, and have an experience of that. I just kind of, you can lean into it and you can see, you know, you've walked in footprints or in footsteps that may be similar. They're not exactly the same, but they're similar. And you have a, you know, kind of an empathy or an understanding.
Yeah, and it is wonderful to see that picture of Amanda up on the wall, and you know, she's so high up that the idea of "don't talk down to me" is so brilliantly brilliantly expressed within that. But maybe bring us back, which I think probably feeds as well into what you're talking about in this new in the new Living with Pride, that the part of that series of events that you are, I suppose the public really became familiar with your work, Joe, back at the time of your mural, the Cladda Embrace, which was on Georgia Street in Dublin, unveiled just before the 2015 marriage referendum. Lots of conversations after that about identity and inclusion. Nothing new there. But just explain what was in that, the Cladda Embrace, what that...
So that was a drawing that I had installed in the months previous to the referendum. So, you know, kind of, we all now know that it was the first time that a nation got to vote on legislation that would allow or prevent same-sex unions or marriage. And it was, we have been lucky maybe over the last number of years, because when, you know, when Ireland has asked some big questions about, you know, who we want to be in the future and to amend legislation that maybe hurts or causes harm to people, that art has been at the forefront of a lot of those conversations. So with the piece for equality, with, you know, kind of the repeal movement, there's lots of big questions that have happened over the last, you know, kind of 5 to 6 years, where art has played and has asked questions. And it allows you, it can, you know, it can allow you into a space or to consider a topic in a more nuanced way.
Unfortunately, though, you know, for all of the positives that and the positive outcomes, I suppose, in terms of the how art expressed what came to be passed in the marriage referendum, and indeed in the repeal, the 8th Amendment referendum as well, we still have
events, like recently when Donald Talbot's posters in Waterford encountered all sorts of homophobic responses.
Yeah, and that was done in response to, you know, kind of people pulling down flags and burning them. You know, because of the yes and that vote in 2015, it doesn't obliterate the daily, you know, kind of ill-placed words or, you know, kind of the, you know, people are still being harassed. There's still hurt being caused and being given over.
How common is that in your experience, Joe?
It is common. It's like my position in school and as a teacher, it's, you know, kind of flippant comments can be thrown around quite easily and they can be very hurtful. And we don't live in a place where you can necessarily express who you are yet without freedom. And it is it's a sore and it's a difficult place. But it's, you know, kind of when I was growing up, there wasn't as many people that were in public life that were open about who they were. And that's different now.
Is the arts world, is it a little bubble where perhaps it's easier to be who you are and to express who you are?
I think so. I think, you know, there is an absolute link between being part of the LGBTIQ plus community and the creative community. But I think it's about freedom. You know, there's a freedom of expression in both. The creative community is a bubble. But, you know, kind of people look to, you know, kind of enjoy that bubble in lots of kind of different ways. And they are absolutely linked. But, yeah, kind of.
And are there particular artists that perhaps you have seen express themselves in a way that gave you courage to go ahead and express yourself in the way you wanted to?
You know, kind of one significant artist who looked at, you know, kind of gender and androgyny was Frida Kahlo. And, you know, she had relationships that weren't seen as, you know, kind of heterosexual relationships. And she was in that kind of grey area, that grey space. And she is, you know, kind of a leader in her field. And it was, she'd be quite interesting. And then, you know, like lots of historic artists, you look at Da Vinci and people like that. So art and, you know, kind of being queer there's always been a crossover there because there's always been a freedom that's there.
And then the event for the National Library, it kind of echoes in some ways what you were saying about Amanda Butler and the piece that you have there, Don't Talk Down to Me. The title of the talk is Look at Me, This Is Who We Are. It's a very similar type of statement, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's there's a pride in it. You know, it's living with pride. You know, you come from a place, like I was born in the early 80s in Ireland, where there was some people, there was no representation in my community. And now being able to go and stand and go, yeah, that's part of me. Mm. It's not the most important part of me, but it is part of me. And having that lived experience has given me power and has allowed me to look into the world where Amanda lives and allows me to express her world on you know, kind of walls that are in the city now.
I suppose, to use that old cliche, lots done, lots more to get, still more to do. Mm. There's a touch of that involved here, isn't there?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I'm sure the talk tomorrow night will be part of that. Great to have you in this evening, Joe. Thanks for calling in. As I said, Joe Caston there. And the panel discussion, Look at Me, This Is Who We Are, will be available online tomorrow evening from the National Library. And you'll get full details on the website, which is nli.ie. Poetry Speaks, Poems and Moving Images, part of the Irish Museum of Modern Art's IMA Outdoors series of events. Poetry Speaks, Poems and Moving Images, as that title suggests, is a series of poetry films seeking to integrate poetry into everyday life. Here's from a short film by Matthew Thompson, is Felly Speaks, reading from the poetry of William Butler Yeats.
When you're old and grey and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes once had and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled. and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars.
Fairly Speaks there with When You Were Old by William Butler Yeats as part of a short film by Matthew Thompson, which is part of Poetry Speaks Poems and Moving Image at the Irish Museum of Modern Art. Part four of this exhibition began today. It runs through until 22nd of August. And this strand of films focuses on the theme of love, includes poems by Andrew McMillan and Seamus Heaney. And the exhibition is the work of the Adrian Birkenhoff Poetry Foundation and Poetry Ireland, Brinkenhoff, I beg your pardon, and is presented in four themed installments. When it comes to filmmaking, it's said that a film is made three times. Firstly, when the writer pens the screenplay, the second time, when the director shoots on set, and then finally, when the editor cuts it all together. In other words, it's the editor who has the last chance to get it right. Well, in the history of American cinema, there is perhaps no editor who got it right more often and who also changed it more profoundly than Dee Dee Allen. Here to talk to us about her importance is Stephen Benedict. But first of all, let's hear some of Dee Dee Allen's editing in action. So you can play a little game with yourself here. Now, can you work out the films that are in this montage?
Some people say I broke those rules first. I certainly did not. I mean, the Russians broke those rules and the Germans broke those rules. This was nothing new, but it was new for Hollywood.
Hey, what's your name anyhow?
Clyde Barron.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Parker. Pleased to meet you.
Is your name Felton? Eddie Felton.
That's right.
I hear you've been looking for me.
I've got you for the rest of your natural born life if you don't watch your step. You want another one?
Yes.
You got it. You got another one right there.
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
I got always going to kill
him. Attica! Attica! Attica!
You separate a man from what he loves the most. What you do is purge what's unique in him. And when you purge what's unique in him, you purge dissent.
Camaraderie.
And when you purge dissent, you kill the revolution. Revolution is dissent.
Camaraderie.
You don't rewrite what I write. No!
Car 2118. Call Greenpoint Hospital and tell them we're bringing in a wounded cop.
All right, hey, the hospital's under new management now. Yeah. Yeah, from now on, free health care for everybody.
So what did you recognise there? Bonnie and Clyde was there, The Hustler was there, The Breakfast Club was there, Red's, Dog Day Afternoon, John Q, and the ambulance siren from the opening scene of Serpico. And indeed, it was the voice of Dee Dee Allen that we heard at the very beginning of that montage. Stephen Benedict in with me this evening to speak about this editor. In fact, that little bit of audio, worthy of Dee Dee Allen herself in terms of its editing, the way the Serpico ambulance siren in particular.
It was brilliant, yeah. And that the thing to note firstly about Dee Dee Allen, she started as a sound editor. And when you hear that, you think, you're encouraged to think that it's maybe it's his heartbeat because we're in the ambulance. And when the picture finally fades up, we realise it's actually the windscreen wipers. So she's constantly, this is one of the great things about Dee Dee Allen, she's constantly playing picture against sound. And that's one of the very, very reasons why we celebrate her today.
So she started in sound. Let you all take note of where these great people come from. But we're talking about a serious legacy in the case of Dee Dee Allen, for sure, Stephen.
Yeah.
As I said, Bonnie and Clyde, The Hustler, The Breakfast Club, you know, there are four or five
classics,
masterpieces. Classics really in there before we go anywhere. What was it about her? What did she do that made her so different, made her so notable?
Well, can I cheat just for a second?
You can.
Let's move beyond the films that she edited and let's look at the people whose careers she actually helped start as an editor, because not only was she incredibly innovative, she was a phenomenal mentor. You can't underestimate how important a mentor she was. No less than four editors who began their careers as interns or assistants to Dee Dee Allen went on to win the Oscar for Best Editing. So when you look at a film like films such as The French Connection, The Deer Hunter, The Right Stuff, Claire Simpson, she was an English editor, she won the Academy Award for editing Platoon. You've got four right there. Then you've also got other interns who then went on to be nominated, although that they didn't win. You've got The Godfather Part Two, The Silence of the Lambs, Hannah and Her Sisters, and Collateral, the Tom Cruise thriller. And then most beautifully of all, her son, Tom Fleischman. Tom Fleischman won the Academy Award for Best Sound Editing on Hugo. And yet for all that, Dee Dee Allen herself never won the Oscar.
That's extraordinary. I mean, was she nominated?
She was. She was nominated three times.
Right.
Now, we may be tempted to think, was she pushed out because she was a woman? But we have Thelma Schoonmaker, who's won many times.
Yeah.
We've got Claire Simpson, we just mentioned. Anne V. Coates won for Lawrence of Arabia back in 63. The reason why Dee Dee Allen seems to have been knocked out was because she was a New York editor. We've got to remember that back in the 50s and 60s, when she began her career, New York was looking west, east across the Atlantic, looking to European filmmakers who were highly experimental. Hollywood, by comparison, was very, very regimented, very, very unionized, very, very conservative. And you heard that in that clip at the very beginning, she said, I didn't break the rules. The Russians broke the rules. You know, she was the first to do it in Hollywood. And so because of that, because she was working in New York, she had to do everything herself. It wasn't as heavily unionized. So she was able to do the ADR, the automated dialogue replacement. She was doing the sound editing as well. And she was able to do all of these things. So she was given the space to experiment, to the point that when she would send the print off to the lab to be processed, she would have to give very, very strict instructions. Do not change this cut. It's deliberate. Okay. So she did a host of really, really important pictures in the 60s. The Hustler with Paul Newman, America, America, a movie written and directed by Aliyah Kazan about Greek immigrants coming to the United States. But she also edited the motherload of modern America. This is the first modern American film, Bonnie and Clyde. It's hard to overestimate how important that film is.
So maybe it's Bonnie and Clyde, but maybe there are other films that really will exemplify for us the sort of innovations that she put into place.
Yeah. Well, when she came in, there was an established way of opening a scene and developing a scene in terms of editing in Hollywood. And that was the way you began with an establishing shot, which is the wide shot of the scene to let everybody know where they were standing in the room. You went in for a medium close-up, then you went for over-the-shoulder shots, and you went back to the wide shot and you faded out. That was the traditional way. What Dee Dee Allen started to do was she, instead of fading out and then fading in, she would cut straight to the opening shot of the next scene. And it wouldn't necessarily be an establishing shot. It would be a close-up sometimes. Mm. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but what she was doing was she was disrupting the expected rhythm that the audience were so accustomed to. And rhythm is really, really important in editing, because it's really effectively, Sean, editing is about the delivery of information and timing it so the audience can absorb the emotions of the characters. So that was one of the things that she was doing. And then what she was also doing was, at the end of the scene, she would then, what's called pre-lap, she would take the sound from the next scene into the end of this very, very first scene before we'd actually finished it. So you're actually hearing two things, or seeing one thing and hearing something else at the same time. And that provided this great impetus and great excitement.
That idea, though, what did you call it? Pre-lapping.
You
know, that idea of the audio from a scene, it's almost, you know, I have my hand out to the side here. It's almost as if the scene starts to creep in underneath the visual.
Completely.
And then suddenly when the visual and the audio match up, you're in a new place. And again, you said that sounds really simple. You say, well, that happens all the time. But the important thing is she was
invented
this
it.
Person
yeah, I
who
mean,
started it.
You can see it. It's on TV shows, CSI, even The Crown. Yeah. You know, The Crown, the most unrevolutionary show, is absorbing these really, really revolutionary ideas that Dee Dee Allen put in place back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, but I wondered about that, because, you know, you mentioned the idea of why did she not get the Academy Award?
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the gender may well have been a part of it, but you're saying the East-West Coast thing was part of it as well. I wondered to what extent was it that the West Coast in particular perhaps was so conservative that these newfangled, albeit European ideas, these newfangled ideas, they weren't going to have any of that.
Well, certainly not. I mean, I think the best example of how she was misunderstood or her ideas weren't embraced is actually, she was actually fired from Bonnie and Clyde. The head of the studio, Jack Warner, despised the film, and his loathing of the film was legendary. And he insisted that she be fired and all her cuts eradicated. But thankfully, Warren Beatty, who starred in the picture, was also the producer of the movie. So he secretly reinstated her and he paid for her wages out of his own pocket. Now, the degree to which Warren Beatty held her in such high reverence can be seen when he went to make his historical epic Reds in 1980. And he went off and he lost the run of himself. He shot over 2.5 billion feet of film. Now, if you put that into layman's terms, that's 462 hours of footage. If you were to start watching it today, right now, Sean, you'd still be watching it in 19 days' time. Dee Dee Allen went in and wove that picture and wove it down to three hours, and it's still regarded as one of the best movies of the late golden age, the second golden age of Hollywood.
3 hours from 462 hours.
Her assistant on that was Craig McKay, who went on to edit The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, and they'd be given out to me when I go a minute over. You know. get it out a minute and 30 seconds if you look at it. Anyway, let's get back to Dee Dee Allen and where she started.
Yeah, she started, well, she was born in 1923 in Cleveland, Ohio, and her father was a businessman, her mother was an actress, and that's where she started going to the theatre and going to the movies. And she expressed from an early age that she wanted to be a film director. And she was told, no, no, you won't be a film director. The best way to become a film director is become an editor. And so she badgered and badgered and badgered the studios. And she finally got a job as a messenger in Columbia Studios out in Hollywood. But when she expressed the wish to become an editor, she was told, you're a woman, you're too small and too frail. You've got to be carrying all these heavy cans and tin cans up the stairs and across the studio floor. So that's what she did. She did. Yeah. She did it. And so her first break came in World War II when she started doing the sound editing in the sound effects department of Columbia Pictures. But when the war ended, the guys came back from the war and her job was gone. So she had to go to New York. And it was there in New York that she got her big break. She started editing. Her first big break really in New York was when she started working on what are called industrial films. Today we'd be calling them corporate videos. Mm. But her first feature film, proper feature film, was a film called Odds Against Tomorrow, directed by Robert Wise. It was a noir thriller in 1959. And Robert Wise later went on to direct The Sound of Music and West Side Story. Okay. And when she went in to edit the first sequence in the film, he was thrilled because she actually insisted on taking out the score. She took out the music from the scene. And the amazing thing is that Robert Wise himself had begun as an editor. And he, one of the first films that he edited was Orson Welles' picture, Citizen Kane. Before he went to Hollywood, Orson Welles worked in the radio, so the sound was the important
thing. Again, we're back to Dee Dee Allen and that background in radio. Actually, there was another clip that I wanted to play was Pietro Scalia. This is another editor, two-time Oscar winner, in fact, for JFK and Gladiator. He is further down the legacy, not directly to Dee Dee Allen herself.
That's right. His mentor was Claire Simpson, who began in Dee Dee Allen's editing suite.
Yeah, let's have a listen to the clip here, and it'll give us a sense of how he learned from Claire Simpson, who learned from Dee Dee Allen.
When I was starting off as an assistant, the best advice I got was from Claire Simpson. And she also had worked with one of the great editors. She was assisting Dee Dee Allen. So she told me the story that Dee Dee Allen told her. She's kind of like the godmother of editors. What Dee Dee Allen told Claire Simpson, and Claire Simpson told me, is like, editing is about rhythm. And that stayed with me as a very good advice. It is rhythm. It moves you. It also reflects the rhythm of your heart in terms of emotion. So rhythm is very important.
Pietro Scala there, two-time Oscar winner for the editing in JFK and Gladiator. Stephen Bendick speaking to me about Dee Dee Allen, one of the all-time great editors. But when they say something like that, you know, it's all about rhythm. That's very well if you understand what the rhythm is. You know, did Dee Dee Allen give us any advice in that score?
Yeah, she did. She cut from the gut. What she always did was she looked at the eyes, the eye movement, and a person with blinking. And we could read the person's emotion through their eyes. So she was constantly, constantly, constantly talking about the eyes. And it was from that she got the emotional intensity, and she cut on that. That was the motivation for the editor.
And as you say, the phrase cut from the gut was important to her. Let's finish up by giving her the last word.
I'm strictly a gut editor. When I started in the film business out here in California, when I was a messenger, when I was a sound editor, and as far as I'm concerned, I just go by my gut. I don't sit and intellectualize about a cut. Directors at the place I worked at Film Graphics for so long, Bernie Rubin was always delighted that I didn't do it necessarily the conventional way. I think it's a gut thing. I go for what I think is interesting. I go for the performance, for the story, and for what I think the film's about. And if it's a good film which has well-written characters and good performances, how can you go wrong?
Dee Dee Allen there, film editor, making it all sound so easy. Stephen Benedict opening up her career to us on this Wednesday evening. But that is our lot for tonight on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again, here on RTE Radio 1.